Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and philosopher, America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of many books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University in the Emerging Economy. Also, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? His blog, oftwominds.com, is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. And it's a pleasure to join you on this conversation in such a volatile, dynamic time in history.
Yes, likewise. Just crazy things happening in the environment in terms of the financial landscape and the financial markets, the economy. So this is not just a financial crisis, it's an economic crisis. Can you update us on your views of this evolving environment, especially based on your recent blog writings, which have been really insightful? Like, why do you see the crash has only begun? Why is the economy not likely to recover? And why is this not another 1929 or 1987 or 2008?
Right. Well, thank you very much. And I will talk about my recent posts. You and I have touched on in previous conversations the concept that I write a lot about, which is intangible capital, meaning the forms of capital that are not easily measurable in the same way that earnings and profits and employment and those kinds of things are. And so I think one of the themes I'm that kind of ties my work together is the idea that if we take Taleb's idea of anti-fragile, we can kind of see that an economy that's anti-fragile, meaning that it has a very robust network, an ecosystem of economic activities that are not necessarily tightly bound. You know, there's redundancy and a lot of network connections that make it anti-fragile. That's a form of capital that we can't measure very easily, but it's a very important form of capital, and we're starting to see that now because we're the fragility of our existing system is now being exposed. You know, the fragility of long supply chains, of single sources, of a very limited number of sources for things such as meat, and that's true of many other commodities in our system. So that's kind of, I think, one of the themes that ties my work together as to why the crash has only just begun. Is my point is that bailouts, which everybody's, you know, very euphoric about right at the moment, the Federal Reserve and other central banks and fiscal policy is bailing everybody out and sending out a lot of free money and loans and so on. That's not a substitute for income. You know, and that's an emergency measure, but it doesn't mean that you've gotten rid of the need for earned income. And of course, what's the main purpose of income? You can say, well, it's consumption, but perhaps more importantly for the financial sector, it's servicing all the debt that exists. And so if you don't have income, you can't really service the debt. And then your financial system, starts breaking down because, unless you're going to go to a full universal basic income for virtually every sector in the economy, and not just the people, but you've got to do it for the businesses. and then you're starting to talk about a level of money creation that's an order of magnitude higher than the $2 trillion the Fed has already created, right? In other words, you're talking about tens of trillions if you're going to really bail out everybody that needs to service debt. So the loss of income is really severe. And I think that, that's why I say the crash has only begun. In terms of why the economy is, why this isn't a rerun of 1929 or 1987 or 2000 or 2008. Number one, this is, of course, an external shock, right? So it's not just a financial crisis of over indebtedness and over speculative euphoria like 1929 or 2000 or even 2008. And it's not a finance sector only crisis, which was like 2008, right? Which was fundamentally a financial sector bubble bursting in subprime mortgages, which was, you know, a very high risk area of a specific sector of the financial economy. But because of the tightly bound connections, connecting the global financial system, the subprime mortgage blowing up ended up almost taking down the entire global financial system. What we have now is an economy-wide collapse. And so I don't think analogies are really realistic. And so that's kind of like my sort of summary of why we're in trouble on a fundamental basis.
And you see, the crash has only just begun. So what is your outlook on the time frame? Like, how does it get worse, and within what time frame? How do you see that evolving?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, we're just guessing, but I think that in terms of income being the foundation of consumption and investment and servicing debt, we're going to really have to focus on that. As like, if income continues to falter or decline, then there's going to be no recovery, right? So investment income is drying up because companies are cutting dividends, right, which they need to do to conserve cash. And then despite the current, you know, four-week rally in stocks, we can look ahead and go, well, it's possible that there's going to be less capital gains in stocks and also in housing, because the impact on the housing market is uncertain, right? It's highly likely that as people factor in the uncertainty in their future income, they're going to be less hesitant to be buying real estate at current valuations, right? So if investment income and capital gains dry up, that's going to hit the top 10% of the households who are responsible for 50% of all consumption, right? Mm-hmm. So that's going to have an outsized impact, you know, on the economy in a number of ways. And then that top 10%, number one, they own 85% of all the assets. Number two, they're responsible for 50% of all the consumption, because they're the consumers of services such as, you know, dog walkers and childcare, you know, CPAs to do their taxes. And, you know, the lower income people don't have the money to provide to buy any of those services. So that's partly why the top 10% is so critical, is they support an enormous amount of consumption and actual service sector employment. So and then they also pay most of the taxes. And so I included a chart here of the capital gains for the state of California, which, as we all know, is by itself more or less the sixth or seventh largest economy in the world. And it's highly sensitive to capital gains. And so if the income of the top 10% who own the assets, if their income is hit from either job-related, you know, earned income declines, they don't get their bonuses anymore, they're not flipping houses for big profits, they're not able to cash in their stock options, then that's gonna crush consumption, and it's gonna crush tax revenues, and that's gonna the dominoes falling mean that it'll put a lot of pressure on local governments, because they cannot print money, as we know, and their ability to borrow it for just operating expenses is also nil. They can only borrow money for infrastructure, so. That's why I see the crash taking a matter of months and perhaps even several quarters to play out. I don't think anybody can have any sense of certainty as to when income will recover to its 2019 levels. In other words, of earned income and investment income. But until income is back up to those levels, then you cannot have the economy running at the same GDP.
Right. It's just crazy what's happening. And given that the shutdown could last even more months than originally thought, and then there's talks about a second wave coming in, a mutated virus that might be stronger going into the fall. So, you know, the shutdown of the actual economy could last even longer, which could further exacerbate these numbers, right, in terms of state tax collections from either state taxes or VAT type of sales taxes as well.
Right, exactly. And then, following up that your topic of the lockdown or the quarantine being released in sort of stages, there's two classes of people that have a sort of an asymmetric influence on employment and income, right? Which is, of course, small business and medium-sized businesses, and which are responsible for the majority of the employment, right? And so naturally, if you're running a business, you're going to be very hesitant to hire back the staff that you furloughed, right? Until you know that you have demand that will be sufficient to actually, you know, pay their wages and cover all costs, right? And so there's going to be a lot of hesitancy and uncertainty on rehiring people. And in terms of people going out and consuming, there's a very large number of people who feel at risk, right? In other words, they're elderly and or, you know, over the age of 60, and then they have an underlying healthcare situation that makes them hesitant to go out to, say, restaurants or films or seeing a play. And so there's going to be, I think, a permanent drag on consumption until people feel extremely confident in something that's going to protect them. And of course, there's, you know, a lot of science going into the vaccine efforts and so on, but there's also kind of rumblings that this could take a year or 18 months, or that any vaccine could only be partial. So there's a lot of unknowns there. And then the other point I'd like to make that I've been writing about recently is, you know, those of us who have been in small business or are self-employed, we know our expenses are sticky. In other words, your landlord's not going to drop your rent. They expect you to get a V-shaped recovery and keep paying the same rent that you were paying 2 months ago, right? And your healthcare provider's not going to give you a discount, and your local taxes are the same. Your fees, you know, your registration fees. I mean, all your expenses are locked in and sticky at mm-hmm. pre-pandemic rates. But meanwhile, right. Your revenues are not sticky. They've
exactly.
plummeted.
Yes.
And so I think that's a huge disconnect, because nobody that's, you know, the landlords are going, well, gee, I need to keep these rents at these levels in order to make my payments and so on. So, but there's just no way that everybody can keep paying pre-pandemic rates. And so that how that will resolve is a big question.
Yeah, and it's just likely now evolving into huge capital losses, capital formation destruction. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Richard, is that you know, the fundamental basis of capitalism is, of course, capital, right? That the capital seeks a return. And so if you're pulling in your horns and you're trying to save cash and you're uncertain about your prospects, that is not conducive to essentially gambling large sums of money to invest in a new line of business or expand one, right? And so I think what we're seeing in terms of investment is just the really obvious stuff. Like, in other words, buying enough servers to handle, you know, your employees working from home and that kind of thing, which is what we saw in Microsoft's earnings report today, right? Is that their business was very strong because bandwidth is going up and people are buying more software and hardware to be able to work from home. But that's just an initial surge, right? If we look further down the road, there's just a lot of uncertainty about things that used to be, even like a few months ago, were considered reasonably safe investments. Like, for instance, alternative energy. That's been a big source of investment return, right? And now we have to wonder, well, if oil is going to stay relatively cheap for an extended period of time, then that removes a lot of the incentives for alternative energy. So that's just one example of many of investment opportunities that are now uncertain. And of course, the markets hate uncertainty. And so that's one reason to doubt this this fantastic rally that's been occurring over the last month. Is how can there be certainty when there's so many uncertainties about pandemic and how we're going to get past it and healthcare and so on. So in a time of extreme uncertainty, then we're going to see less investment and therefore less return on that investment. That would be my expectation.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a lot of implications of what's happening now to the real economy and the financial markets. Let's explore that in more detail. So if we can look at specific economic sectors and how they are likely to evolve in terms of where they're going, how they're changing, where the jobs are, and just how it plays out. So let's take a look at, for example, education. So you've written about this in your book, The Nearly Free University. That actually seems to be happening now, like almost overnight. There's been a move to a lot of online training. What are your thoughts on that? How do you see the education sector playing out?
That's a great topic, Richard. And of course, I wrote my book 8 years ago, and so it is kind of odd to see it blossoming under this sort of pressure of the pandemic. The question now is, can institutions justify their extremely expensive infrastructure? And can they make their campuses and classrooms safe enough for classes to resume in fall? And then the other question is, are students rethinking the $120,000 investment in a standard bachelor's degree? And I think there's a lot of room here for institutions who are willing to accept the fact that things are not going to return to normal to develop new models and new models of education and also training for like real world applications. And so in my book, I suggested that the more cost effective format would be online, you know, learning for the basics, right? The stuff where, students have been cramming 300 into some huge class or they're already been taking online courses. The basics can be handled online for virtually no cost, right? And then in terms of like, learning lab skills or, you know, workshops in the real world, those can be handled in workplaces, you know, with small groups of people that in a pandemic environment could be sort of hardened against infections, right, by social distancing and people wearing masks and that kind of thing. And so in this kind of apprenticeship model, if you will, there's just a huge amount of courses and skill sets that can be taught in existing workplaces, and the students really don't need a campus. And so that goes against the grain of like, well, you're going to college in order to make new friends and have these social experiences. But if large groups of people are no longer allowed to gather, then that social function of college is not going to be able to be met in the current system anyway. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a structure where you can still meet people, but just in smaller groups, and it would be more related to real world skills than going to some campus and sitting in a group, a big hall with 300 people to take a class you could take online.
And do you see also along with that the decline or going away of accreditation, you know, in terms of, you've written a lot about this as the cartelized education industry?
Well, I would love to see some institutions develop different models for accreditation where instead of it was the number of courses you took or the number of hours of instruction you took, it was like what you actually learned. In other words, somebody might only take 2 years of courses, but if they acquired all the knowledge in their major and the rest of the basics, you know, in history and social studies and so on, well, then they would be granted the diploma based on what they have learned, as opposed to how many courses they took. And of course, that would completely upend the entire cartel because then the incentive would be to go ahead and learn as much as you could instead of just grinding through a bunch of courses. So to your point, there's an enormous amount of opportunity here, but it's going to require the entrenched interests basically losing power. And so if you have a campus with hundreds of highly paid administrators, you know, overseeing student diversity and the athletic program and all this kind of stuff, if all that goes away, then of course there's a lot of people that were making, you know, $150,000, $200,000 a year for pushing paper, but not really actually involved in teaching or actual learning. All those jobs are going to go away. And so that's going to be a huge body blow to the sort of highly paid top 5% of households who've kind of gotten accustomed to a lot of overpaid paper pushing kinds of jobs, not just in education, but also in healthcare and government and a lot of other institutions that really should downsize and become far more efficient as the overall economy shrinks.
Mm-hmm. And so along with that, you see the declining pricing in terms of the structure of pricing. There's been even a lot of protests recently at universities where the tuitions have still remained high, you know, although it's been a short period of time, but the move to online has resulted in people questioning already, you know, why am I paying, you know, still the high rates when we're only getting online? It's not the same education. Your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a very good example of the deflationary impact of technology and also the reworking or the rearrangement of these sort of rigid cartels. And, you know, we can see the same thing in healthcare. Like I'm a member of Kaiser Permanente, right, which is a nonprofit HMO in California and Hawaii and a few other states here in the U.S. And it's considered one of the more fairly valued healthcare providers, and in a sense, it's not a for profit. And I just got an email that says, "Well, you know, from now on, you know, everything's going to be online, and so would you please schedule a, you know, video conference with your doctor?" And so, as an example of, well, gee, that's actually a positive. I don't have to get in my car. I don't have to drive X number of miles to a clinic, then I don't have to wait in line. I don't have to be exposed to all these other ill people and with who knows what they've got, possibly the COVID-19. If not that, then some other, you know, bug. It's going to be a huge plus, but it's all like, well, then why am I paying tens of thousands of dollars?
Yeah.
And then if the COVID-19, for example, if that virus, if there's a test that becomes available at, you know, a home test, well, then we can foresee like this whole pathway for an enormous number of tests can be just administered at home. And so you don't have to go to the clinic or the hospital and you don't have to get a bill for $5,000 for a few tests. So there could be a massive deflation in the healthcare sector to the benefit of everybody except the for-profit parts of that industry.
Yeah. The healthcare sector, exactly. What about in agriculture sector? How do you see that being transformed? Is it to more localized, decentralized form instead of the large agribusiness? Do you see more local models on that for farming?
Well, that's a great topic and a good example, Richard. And I think the context here is why we've developed such a fragile economy is we've allowed these critical functions to be extremely concentrated in a few hands, right? That extremely centralized. So where there used to be, say, 500 slaughterhouses, or in fact, it used to be that any farmer could legally slaughter their own animals and sell the meat. That's now, you know, outlawed in most places. And so now we have like less than 100 huge slaughterhouses. And so as they go down, then the whole system's disrupted. And you can, of course, look at the media with six major media companies. You can look at the major money center banks. There's only a handful, the mortgage sector. And throughout the whole economy, there's either a cartel or a monopoly. And so that concentrated power and capital in a few nodes of the network make that network extremely vulnerable to disruption. And now we're seeing that in agriculture. On a deeper point, a number of people, I think there was an article in The Guardian, in the UK paper, that a lot of the viruses that and bacteria that are arising that are resistant to treatment come out of these huge big ag facilities because they're sort of breeding grounds for these kinds of pathogens that small family farms of the old model it's highly unlikely that you're going to get a spread of food poisoning, say, in such a small node in a much larger network, where if there's only six slaughterhouses or six facilities that are generating most of the food, then any kind of pathogen in any one of those plants can spread to a huge part of the population. So again, I think the model is that we've lost our redundancy and our network has become really fragile. And so the move to decentralize agriculture and as part of what we call food security, which means that if you want a secure food supply, you're going to have to decentralize it and create a lot more redundancy and a more resilient network. And so these systems still exist, but financially it's been extremely difficult for small farmers or small providers or small stores to exist under with such a highly regulated and very expensive regulatory structure. So, for instance, if you want to legally slaughter an animal, you know, kill an animal and cut it up into meat and then sell that to the general public, you have to meet an enormous amount of regulations, right, which are extremely expensive. So that means it's illegal for someone that has some goats or sheep or a cow to slaughter their own. And in most places, and they can't sell to the public. They, you know, even if you can, if you are allowed to do that, then you can only consume it yourself. And so, and then if any regulation is broken, then there's these enormous punitive fines. You know, it's not uncommon to have some small food provider facing a $10,000 fine for violating, you know, one of the immense numbers of regulations. And so, you can, if you look at the documentaries that are out there, the video documentaries on farming in the U.S., North America, and in the European Union, you'll come across farmers complaining about the paperwork they have to fill out, and that most of their time is spent filling out paperwork. And because if they don't meet every tiny, dot every I on every regulation, then they're going to be fined some huge amount of money by some gigantic bureaucracy. So we've constructed a system, to sort of summarize, that favors gigantic global corporations who have the financial means to deal with this enormous regulatory burden. So we're going to have to strip away a lot of regulatory burden and get back to some sort of common sense, light regulatory where we focus solely on, you know, public safety and so on. But we're not, just adding regulations by the thousands, because we're basically destroyed, the ecosystem of agriculture in doing that.
Exactly. And so what about the retail sector? Actually, there's a link potentially with the retail sector to the ag sector, I think, in that as you know, we move to online retailing, you know, using Amazon or Shopify-based businesses. What about those shopping malls out there? Do you see the potential of those shopping malls, you know, given a lot of these companies like JCPenney, Macy's, Neiman Marcus all going out of business? Maybe these shopping malls could be used for agriculture, like for vertical farming methods, techniques, or freight containers.
Interesting idea, Richard, because, yeah, the I don't know that most people know that your basic retail space or shopping mall is really thinly constructed. You know, it's basically a bunch of steel studs with a thin, you know, walls. And so it's not a very robust structure. You're not talking about a brownstone built in, you know, 1890 or a steel frame skyscraper. These are really flimsily constructed, so that they would be ideal for some kind of light use like that, like basically greenhouses. But, you know, you raise an interesting point too here, that another industry that's critical in the financial sector, which is commercial real estate. And so if we're going to work from home on a significant basis from now on, and the economy is going to shrink by some percentage, and then there's going to be a huge oversupply of commercial spaces and like office space and retail space. And it's going to be very hard to repurpose a lot of that for the same reason, is they're very lightly constructed. They don't have enough plumbing or electrical service to, like, say, turn them into housing. You know, that would be a major difficulty, to take a building with a handful of bathrooms and, you know, basically a bunch of office floors or cubicles and turn that into dwellings. That would require probably very close to just ripping it down and starting over. Mm-hmm. So I think, but there's a lot of financial debt piled up on these commercial spaces. And so when they, if the rents plummet to zero or near zero, and there's bankruptcies, there could be like a domino effect through that sector. And of course, you and I have talked in the past about, in the U.S., there's something like 5 times more retail space per person than in Europe. And so the amount of surplus retail and commercial space in North America is just enormous. Like, in other words, you're talking about you could lose half of it and you might still be oversupplied.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on tourism and travel? Like, where do you see the future of that going?
Yeah, it's that's a great topic too. And of course, again, we see a domino effect that tourism is, I believe, around 5 to 10% of global GDP. I mean, it is certainly one of the largest global industries, right? And it's an industry that a great many developing world countries have become dependent on, right?
Yeah.
And exactly. Again, to speak of fragility, this is another example of it, that in a globalized economy, every local economy gets stripped out of anything that's not competitive on a global scale. And then what they are competitive on, that becomes the dominant industry. So I'm thinking of Southeast Asia, which you know well too, better than I do, tourism has become the primary source of income for a great many people, small vendors, you know, Airbnb hosts, hotels, guest houses, you know, food stalls, on and on and on. And but the problem is that the rest of their economy has stagnated, if you will, because everyone said, well, the big money is in tourism, right? That's where we can make more cash income. And so now that that's been basically destroyed or set back, then there's not going to be a ready sort of backup plan, you know, some other source of income or employment. And so it's going to be extremely difficult for the developing world, you know, locales that have become dependent on tourism. And even in North America, or including Mexico and the US and Canada, there's huge numbers of places which are completely tourist dependent. I'm thinking San Francisco. I'm thinking Victoria, BC. I'm thinking Acapulco. So what happens if tourism stays depressed for whatever reason, whether people are fearful of getting on a crowded aircraft, if they don't have the income, if they're going to put that vacation plan aside because they need to save more money, for whatever reason, that's going to have an outsized effect on the global economy, I think, because so much of the global economy depends on tourism as their primary industry.
No, so at least short term, it may rely on whether the economy is locked down or not. There's reports now that Sweden is taking advantage. A lot of people looking to Sweden to go there since they're not locked down. So there's been a lot of activity on travel. Other destinations I've heard in Sicily, they're offering half-priced airfares, one night out of three nights for free, you know, to attract people as the economy opens back up. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I'm currently in Hawaii, where they're taking a rather strict view. They really don't want tourists here. There's a 14-day quarantine if you arrive in the state as a tourist, and wow, you will be arrested if you break that. And the way it's being contextualized locally is that the Hawaiian residents are looking at tourists as being responsible for the locals' health. In other words, if we can't verify that you are, you know, virus free, then it's your responsibility to stay quarantined until we can be assured that you are safe. And so this of course seems like a luxury, right? That you're saying, well, we're only going to allow in tourists who have been tested. But I think that's really the future of tourism. And so for example, in Japan, they're already trying to ramp up or anticipate the idea that if you're going to travel overseas, you will arrive at the airport 3 hours early. You will be tested as soon as you get there. Test results will be available within an hour or something. And then if you test negative, then you are allowed to get on your plane. And then you will be given some certificate that you are virus-free, right? Mm-hmm. And so then that will alleviate, you know, all the concerns of the people in the destination. So I think that's really the kind of thing that we're going to be seeing in global tourism. We're going to have the testing capacity in real time or close to it. In other words, not days or even multiple hours, but we're going to have a test that's kind of like essentially within an hour or less, yeah, you know, and that there's a lot of people working on that. So I think that's quite feasible. And I think that kind of like the 9/11 impact was that now you have to go through a line and there's you have to step into a scanner, you know, to scan you and your belongings and so on. And it's a little bit of a hassle, right? It adds an hour to the whole process. But I think if the COVID-19 pandemic can be handled in the same way, like, okay, you have to get to the airport an hour early and get tested and get this certificate, that's doable. In other words, that's a way that global tourism could come back. Then the question becomes, how comfortable do people feel investing, if you will, or spending on what's superfluous? In other words, Do they feel they have enough cash reserves for the future? How uncertain is their income and so on? And I would be very surprised if tourism could come back to more than, say, 50%, even with the kind of system I'm describing, simply from the uncertainties to people's income. Mm-hmm. That and of course, very few, only the top slice, maybe the top 5% households have enough financial reserves to weather any kind of extended period of uncertainty. So to be blowing $5,000 on some, you know, week at a resort, that's a really unwise use of money for anybody other than the super wealthy. So I think we're going to see tourism being at much lower levels for an extended period of time. Again, it's all based on income. If income stays lower than 2019, then there's no way tourism can come back, because lenders have also, you know, have to face the reality that with uncertainty in their borrowers, then they're going to have to tighten up their lending standards, or else they're going to just be guaranteeing huge waves of defaults. So less credit, more expensive credit, certain wariness about spending money as opposed to saving some, all of those are going to depress tourism and consumption in general, in my view. And that's actually prudent. In other words, if a family or a household or a business doesn't have enough cash on hand to survive a month, that should be their first priority. Mm-hmm. Is get some sort of reserve, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah.
And then over and above that, I mean, it depends on priority, as it has in the past, where, for example, the millennials, perhaps their priority is more on travel than buying a house or a car. So, you know, I guess there's that to consider as well. And I think, yeah, the Japan approach looks like it might be the feasible way, because there's been a lot of concerns of, you know, people who do not want to have to get a vaccine, you know, or get the vaccination for COVID, or have to travel with a medical certificate. There's been talks about that, whether it's embedded as a chip, you know, in everybody, or through some type of digital certificate document or physical document. The Japan approach goes all around that and provides a much more reasonable, as you mentioned, maybe an extra hour, a couple hours at the airport, and then you're all set. You know, you go from there. So maybe that becomes the norm.
Yeah, and as you say, there's a lot of doubt in the scientific community as to whether immunity from a vaccine would actually be durable, mm-hmm. or 100%. So yeah. It might be better just to say, well, all we're trying to do is make sure that we can verify that this passenger doesn't have the virus at this point in time. And that's going to have to be good enough.
Right.
But, you know, Richard, I know we're running out of time, but it's an interesting point you make about the generational impact. And I think that, you know, you have to wonder what is going to be the impact on investments such as stocks and housing if the younger generation decides that those are not priorities. Then who's going to buy, you know, the millions upon millions of houses as the baby boom generation downsizes or retires or so on? And so that's another huge impact that's not the result of the pandemic, but could be accelerated by the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And actually, speaking of that, in terms of globalization, do you see a move somewhat away from globalization towards more decentralized economy and even protectionism for economic sectors? And how do you see that playing out in the potential for offshore jobs returning to the developed world, like, for example, IT service call centers?
Yeah, it's a great idea and a good topic, because a lot of people talk about reshoring, and a lot of people are skeptical that they feel that, well, there's just going to be automation, you know, that the jobs that were, if we do move sectors back to North America, it's going to be automated, and therefore there won't be any jobs coming back. But, you know, we're talking about food as one example, and food security. And so there's also a move, I think, in national security circles, at least, to consider national security related to technology. In other words, maybe we should only have semiconductor plants here that we're gonna have chips put in our military equipment. You know, we're gonna want to control all that to make sure that there's no back doors to potential enemies and that kind of thing. And so I think that so-called reshoring of industries makes a lot of sense if you look beyond profit. And that's where I think the vulnerability or the fragility of the current system is relies really largely on the idea that the sole goal was always just to maximize profit by any means available, as opposed to considering other values and other forms of capital that are important. So once we start saying, well, actually, food security is a form of intangible capital that we now consider important, then you're going to let go of the profitability of flying grapes, you know, 5,000 miles or something because it's 10 cents a pound cheaper. You're going to say, no, we're going to go ahead and pay the extra dime or 15 cents to have it sourced locally. And there's a lot more employment if we do that. And so if we value employment, then we're going to want to reshore these critical industries. And just to take a quick example, one of my correspondents grows microgreens in Ohio, and he used to grow microgreens and deliver them to restaurants, and now most of those are closed. And so now he's delivering to small local grocery stores, neighborhood, you know, stores, not mm-hmm. chains. And so so if we relocalize, there's actually a potential for a lot of jobs, and they may not all be high paying, but they would be considered essential, and people would have a livelihood that they could feel good about. You know, they'd have a positive role in the economy. So I consider that highly, highly positive if we went in that direction.
Yeah. And actually, your final thoughts in that regard, for a last question of the day here, in terms of the silver lining of what's happening, where do you see the positive aspects? So one would be just this that you just mentioned. And what are your thoughts there to end on a positive note?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're talking about these huge sectors like healthcare and higher education and local government that are really kind of crying out for much more efficient systems. And so I think there's a great potential for new businesses and small businesses as we sort of decentralize these really fragile networks. And we, if you want to put it in one way, it would be we're sacrificing the centralized efficiencies for a more diversified economy that supports more jobs. Mm-hmm. And so you could say, well, maybe corporations aren't going to earn $1.5 trillion in this economy. Maybe they'll only earn $500 billion. But they'll be if we can create 10 or 20 million more jobs out of that, then there'll be a much broader range of opportunities for people. Tax revenues will have a more secure base, and there'll be all these other benefits from a relocalized economy. And there'll be a lot more opportunity for small entrepreneurs, you know, in that environment.
Oh, great insight and ending on a positive note. Thank you very much, Charles. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com, and there's sample chapters of all my books for free, and all my archives are free.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles.
Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.